Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Welcome back, Jeanies. It is Extreme Jeans Family History Radio and ExtremeJeans.com. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. I was in New York researching and having an overall good time. Saw Wicked on Broadway, went to a Mets game. They lost, which is what the Mets typically do, so it felt so right. And had the coolest experience of all. I was given a personal tour of the David Letterman set at the Ed Sullivan Theater moments after shooting the Late Show episode with Steve Martin visiting. I even got to sit at Letterman's desk with my wife in the guest chair and shoot some pictures, and to visit with Paul Schaefer from the CBS Orchestra and Alan Coulter, the announcer. This was especially fun for me because my dad used to take me to the Ed Sullivan Theater for rehearsals of the Ed Sullivan Show when I was a boy because he was the music arranger for the program for the entire run. So being on that set was indeed a family history experience. You can check out the picture from the set on ExtremeJeans.com. And I got to give a shout out, too, to my half-second cousin Jim and his wife Ginny, who were kind enough to host us for a day at their home in Pawcatuck, Connecticut, on the Rhode Island border. In going through his old pictures and trinkets, we found a pocket watch with a photo of my great-grandfather, Andrew Jackson Fisher, on the face of it. It was a gift to Jim's great-grandmother, and only the third picture of him that we've found. On another day in Fairfield, Connecticut, at the Historical Society there, I was given the opportunity to photograph and be photographed with the Bible brought from England in the early 1600s by one of my ninth great-grandfathers, Humphrey Hyde. Also in their collection on the family was an 18th-century sword, so you can see that photo gallery also at ExtremeJeans.com. I'll tell you what, if you ever have a research trip half as fun as this one was, you are doing well. Today on the show, very excited to have on the founder of FindAGrave.com, Jim Tipton. It was recently announced that FindAGrave was purchased by Ancestry.com. And you got to ask the question, what does this mean to you and me? Well, we'll ask Jim about that and find out the behind-the-scenes story about how his amazing site began. It wasn't originally meant to be a family history site. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about six family names that may mean you're descended from a famous English pirate. So we asked the question, do you know if you descend from a pirate? And I can actually say yes to that, though he wasn't particularly famous. Several of you also answered yes. That combined with the answer arg tells me that we may have a pretty fair number of pirate descendants who listen to the show. This week, our survey is on Find a Grave, of course, since we're going to be talking to its founder, Jim Tipton, in a few minutes. Have you ever made a great discovery using Find a Grave? I'm sure many people have. I have. And we'll have the results for you next week. Cast your vote at ExtremeJeans.com. All right, this week's featured news. Actress Mariel Hemingway is coming out with a documentary on her family history. And you probably realize that her grandfather was the great author Ernest Hemingway. The documentary is called Running from Crazy. It's framed around the challenges of mental illness, anxiety, and depression that her family has dealt with, leading to several suicides, including that of her sister Margot Hemingway back in 1996. Mariel says it was a tough project to do because she had to face it head on, so many of these demons in the creation of this film, but it was ultimately uplifting and she hopes helpful to people who have similar struggles. Great for her, and hopefully it will help a lot of people. Read the whole story on ExtremeJeans.com. A study of the naming of recent babies shows a new old trend. Grandma names are making a comeback. Yeah, these are names that may make you think of an elderly woman in a hoop skirt. The stir at CafeMom.com says that this is kind of a response to the celebrity names that have made news lately, like Apple and North. So the article gives a list of 30 grandma names that includes Gertrude, Esther, Lottie, Nanny, Beulah, Flossie, Gladys, Mildred, Mamie, Myrtle, Bertha, Dixie, I like Dixie, Trixie, Kitty, Winifred, Edith, Irma, Ruth, Ethel, Hattie, Fanny, Agnes, Golda, Delia, and Bessie. All grandma names, I think we would agree. Question is, would you be brave enough to give your daughter one of these names? And I'm talking, by the way, as a first name, not just as a middle name to honor your grandmother or great-grandmother. The article is linked at ExtremeJeans.com. Also on the website, We often think of New Orleans, Montreal, and Quebec in general as French settlements, but rarely Detroit, the Motor City. But it was, and a great story in the Detroit News tells us about some descendants of the original French settlers who are upset that Detroit hasn't embraced its French heritage, particularly as Montreal and New Orleans have for the benefit of tourism. Kevin Lucy, who is one of these descendants, says he feels a sense of responsibility to Detroit and honor his ancestors by promoting old traditions. He says he participates in a few groups and works to promote and restore the city, and he's proud of what he's doing. Some great stories in there, by the way, on these founders. Did you know, for instance, that Cadillac was not originally the name of a car? Come on. No, it was the family name of a French founder of Detroit. And if you check out this article linked at extremejeans.com, I hope your French is good, because here's a sample. Jacob Lomespreu de Melsac was a sergeant in the French army and accompanied Antoine Lomé de la Mothe, Sieur de Cadillac, to Detroit in 1701. You get the idea. I mean, it's tough. I know many of you, by the way, catch the show by podcast, perhaps long after the original airing of the show on radio. So if you're looking for a story we're talking about sometime later and don't see it on extremejeans.com, use keywords. Each story has them. For instance, in the story we just talked about, keywords like Detroit and French will get you there. Just plug them in the search area. Speaking of Michigan, thank you to Nicole Leach, who listens to the podcast, for the kind email. She lives there. Great comment from Jeanette, by the way, in North Carolina about our visit with caller Robbie a few weeks ago, who called our Extreme Jeans find line at 1-234-56-JEANS and shared her great story about the discovery of her African-American revolutionary soldier, one of the best calls we've ever had. Jeanette says, it inspires me to hear other people's stories and successes like Robbie's. I was about to give up on one of my lines, but am now more determined than ever to crack through that wall. Good luck on that, Jeanette. There are so many new tools coming out all the time and so many new records being digitized. I've taken 30 years on a couple of lines that finally broke in the last two or three. And remember, once again, the Extreme Jeans fine line number, 1-234-56-JEANS. That's 1-234-56-JEANS. I don't know how we got it, but I'm glad we did. Well, we're only on the air an hour a week. The fine line is open 24/7 for your stories, comments, or questions. And we're happy to get back to you if you leave your contact information. We love having great finds on the show. All right, coming up next, the founder of Find a Grave, Jim Tipton, on how it all started, the purchase by Ancestry.com, and where it goes from here on Extreme Jeans Family History Radio and ExtremeJeans.com. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Jeans Family History Radio and ExtremeJeans.com. I am your radio root sleuth, Fisher, and very excited to have Jim Tipton on the line, the founder of FindAGrave.com. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, you know, looking at your profile here, I think I like you already because I am a huge fan of The Godfather and Godfather 2. It was on AMC the other night, and it still rocks.
It does.
You know? So tell us about how you started this whole Find a Grave thing, because you did it in 1995 with a whole different idea in mind than what it became.
Yes, exactly. I'll give you kind of the nutshell history. First of all, 95 is, you know, the infancy of the web, so that was a long time ago.
You were very early on this.
Yeah, very early, and I was kind of a nerdy insomniac and looking for outlets for my nerdy insomniac ways, and I put up a web page like some people were doing in those early days of the internet, and I was into visiting famous graves. So speaking of the Godfather, I went up and visited Al Capone's grave. Was one of the first famous ones I visited, and I just had, you know, maybe 100 listings that I had kind of gotten from reading biographies and things, and it was just something interesting to put up. Again, it was just more about learning HTML. And as soon as that went on online, there really weren't that many websites, so people were kind of checking out any new website that came online at the time. And people started sending me, like, you got to have Elvis on that list, and they started sending me, oh, you know, Marilyn Monroe needs to be on there. And again, this was just famous names initially. And it's literally kind of snowballed from there. You know, our famous database expanded very, very quickly. Again, all user-submitted content. This was before user-submitted content was really a phrase that anyone used.
So this was a hobby then?
Yeah, it was a total hobby. I didn't set out to start it as a business or anything like that. And I ran it as a hobby for years. It just grew and grew. And, you know, maybe 15 years ago, I removed the the fame criteria and just said, you know, some of these people are kind of marginally famous. Let's just get rid of that whole fame barrier. And that really opened the floodgates for, you know, these massive amounts of submissions to flow in. And so I just started creating interfaces where people could add, you know, add their relatives, add their friends, so on. And it's just, like I said, it's just snowballed from there to the point where now we're at 106 million names. And almost 90 million photos. Of course, the advent of the digital camera massively increased the the hobby. You used to shoot film and then have to scan it, and it was kind of a painful process. And
it gives me a picture in my mind of standing on a piece of ground, and suddenly the ground starts rising, and you're just on it, and it just keeps going.
It's essentially been that. I'm just trying to stay perched on top of that that rising mountain. But that's a very good description, because I never in a million years thought it would kind of turn into what it has. And again, it's just been this kind of grassroots, slow build. I mean, it's been around for 18 years, so it took us a while to get to where we are, but it's been just kind of slow and steady growth. And this incredible community has emerged of volunteers and people who are, you know, care about their local history or their own family. And it's been terrific to see.
Now, let me ask you, Jim, were you a family history fan before all this came along?
Yeah, I was not really. I did not come to this from the family history angle. Like I said, it kind of started as famous graves. I liked doing research and kind of the thrill of the hunt. So I loved getting out into a cemetery and trying to find, you know, a certain name or whatever, someone who, you know, before the internet existed or before Find a Grave existed, it was hard to go figure out where.
Sure.
You know, Marilyn Monroe is buried or whatever. So, yeah, I didn't come to it from a family history angle, but I certainly recognize that that's largely what the site is used for nowadays. And that's been terrific, and it's been great for me to kind of see that, get accustomed with that community and you know, see the site used for all these different purposes. And, you know, family research is certainly one of the biggest ones.
Well, Jim, we have to kind of get you into this community. It sounds like you're still kind of an outlier here.
Well, I don't know if I'm an outlier at this point,
yeah.
But I think I'm pretty well in that community. And, you know, people, like I said, it's the most common use for the site. So I'm used to a lot of the issues that go around with, you know, that community.
So when people started doing their families and the like, you obviously had to start getting some stories that really got you excited or touched your heart. Why don't you share a few of those with us?
Yeah, well, we get a ton of great stories. In fact, there's a section on the site called Success Stories where we post just a few of, a handful of them. But the best stories, frankly, are these family stories where someone will find maybe a long-lost cousin, a living one, because they're both, contributors onto the site, and one will leave flowers on someone's memorial, and they might have the same last name or whatever, and they'll get a hold of each other, and they'll write in and say, I found some long-lost family member. There's also, of course, people who find relatives on their site, a headstone or something, and it provides some closure or fills in a gap in their family research that they're trying to do. We hear that all the time.
Oh, yeah. It sure has for me on many occasions.
Kind of like the online sources, but, cemeteries are this incredible treasure trove of information, and the whole point of Find a Grave is to get those in an accessible format where you can, you know, browse the nation's cemeteries from your armchair. So in other fun stories, kind of fun, or not fun necessarily, but different sorts of stories are, there's been cases where police have found missing headstones, and they've used Find a Grave to reunite the headstone to the proper plot, like where vandals have stolen them.
Hmm.
Even we had a diver found a class ring from like 1913 or something. When he was, you know, underwater diving, and he used Find a Grave to find out, he found the family member who it belonged to, and was able to reunite the ring with the with the original owner, or the descendants of the original owner. So there's been a ton of great stories like that, and we love hearing them, and you know, that's a big part of what I'm proud of at Find a Grave.
We're talking to Find a Grave founder Jim Tipton. And, Jim, of course, you just purchased by Ancestry.com. Congratulations on that. That's got to blow your mind as well from where it started to that.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the congratulations.
And we'll talk more about that coming up in the next segment. I did want to ask you about how do you manage, because I'm sure it must happen, phony biographies or phony grave sites, you know, as part of your growing pains, you had to have run into a few of those somewhere along the way.
Yeah, there are, the site's open to the public. It's free. always has been, always will be. And anytime you have a site like that, you will, of course, get some, you know, kids or vandals who get in there and try to be, you know, whatever, just add bogus names. We have enough eyeballs on the site, you know, visitors every day, millions of them, that usually that stuff gets reported us to pretty quick, and we've got, you know, facilities built into the site where we can just shut down their account quickly and remove all their content. So they usually give themselves up pretty, you know, pretty easily. So it's not a huge problem, to be honest. But and I'm sure we certainly have errors. Anytime you have 106 million names,
sure,
we certainly have some errors out there.
Well, some of the stones themselves have errors.
Yeah, exactly. and it sounds ironic, but we are kind of a living site, and we are constantly, you know, making corrections to the data. Again, where there's so many people visiting the site that we've got a pretty good set of proofreaders, and they're constantly submitting corrections, and the site gets better and better every day.
Now, when you started, you said it was just a hobby. And so you obviously were doing some other kind of work. What point did you go full-time to this?
Yeah, I used to work for the Huntsman Cancer Institute up there in Salt Lake, and I think it was about 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, that I quit doing that. I kind of tapered my hours off up there because Find a Grave was taking more and more of my time, and like I said, I think it was about 8 years ago that I started doing it full-time.
And how many people do you have working for you?
We have a pretty skeletal staff. We have mostly this terrific set of volunteers that have been with us for years. Anyone who uses the site a lot will probably know these kind of senior administrator guys who have been so helpful volunteering for the site for years. And then we have some people who help out answering this crush of email, basically doing support that comes in every day.
Isn't that great? You know, I have a friend in my neighborhood who is a volunteer who goes out and takes pictures in the cemetery nearby. And I guess you've got it set up where if somebody requests something because maybe those stones are not posted yet, that these volunteers will go out and do that. How many people do you have like that around the world and around the country?
Yeah, we've got over 1 million registered contributors. I think it's about 1.5 million.
Wow.
Not all of them are active in that photo request program. But just to explain what that is briefly, basically what you said, you might find your long-lost aunt in upstate New York, and you're not planning to travel there anytime soon. But you push a button that says, I'd like to see a photo of the headstone, if it's not already there. An email goes out to all of our contributors that live near that cemetery, and usually within, like, a day, maybe a week, you'll get an email back saying that photo's been taken and posted to Find a Grave. And it's one of the most successful parts of Find a Grave, and it's really one of the ones I'm most proud of because it helps people make kind of personal connections. You know, seeing that name etched in stone is a lot has a lot more gravity to it than just simply seeing the name typed out on the screen. So, and it works tremendously well. It's got like an 82% overall success rate.
Wow.
I think, which is pretty phenomenal, I think.
Oh, it is. You're right.
And it's only due to the fact that we have tens of hundreds of thousands of these volunteers who have said, I'll go do this, and they do. And it's now worldwide, so we're starting to see people all over the world sign up to be a volunteer.
Any problems with the cemeteries when this thing first started, when the volunteers started showing up and taking pictures? Because I know some places, they supposedly don't even allow you to take photographs of stones.
Yeah, I've never understood that policy.
Me either.
In a cemetery, like, I don't know who it's damaging. But some cemeteries have that. The biggest thing we've heard from cemeteries is that happening so much, which we just kind of see it as it means Find a Grave is successful, but it's happening so much that their office is having to handle too many requests for plot numbers. And some of them have grumbled at that, but by and large, most cemeteries are, they know why they're there. People are there to help other people or fill in a family, you know, a family tree spot or whatever. And so mostly what we hear are positive things from cemeteries saying, you know, we're happy to help.
I would think at this point, most all of them know what you do, know who you are, know who they are, the volunteers, and what you're trying to accomplish. So that's pretty fun, though. You must have seen an education process over the years until it reached that point.
We did, yeah. And in many of the cemeteries, not many, but there are several cemeteries that have, you know, even signed up kind of as a cemetery account with Find a Grave, and they will kind of manage their own names within their cemetery. And we've seen them be cooperative with the volunteers, too, where they'll print out you know, maybe their list of names so that you don't have to go to the office. You can just reference it yourself and go find the photo. So it's been a good relationship with cemeteries for the most part.
It sounds like it. And have you seen some of them actually change their policy as a result of Find a Grave?
Not that I know of. I've never heard of that. I've heard of a few cemeteries just saying we will no longer, that you have to be a family member if you're going to come in and request a plot or whatever.
I mean, in terms of the photographing of the stones.
No, I've never heard of them reversing policy. That's, again, I find that such an odd policy.
Yeah.
A really minority of cemeteries that have that. And, I mean, you know, we encourage people to obviously respect the rules of a cemetery, but...
But if it's your family member, you know, which is the greater? I mean, that's the issue in my mind, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I would certainly hate for a cemetery to tell someone that they couldn't go photograph my grandmother's headstone.
Yeah.
Because I kind of feel like I own... not own that headstone, but I have the rights to say that.
I think that's the case. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, conversely, I also understand that some people find it jarring to get online and see a family member's headstone, and we hear that side of it too sometimes, and they'll be maybe outraged initially, and if they write to us and politely say, you know, please take this down or whatever, we generally respect that request too.
Interesting.
But a lot of people see it, they find it a little bit jarring, and then they'll look around and they'll say, I just spent 3 hours surfing through Find a Grave, and at first I thought it was this odd, quirky site that came up in a Google search results or something. But after poking around, I've signed up, and now I'm a photo volunteer or something.
Isn't that great?
It is great, yeah.
All right, Jim, you've been bought by Ancestry.com. We want to hear what that means for Find a Grave. We'll get into that coming up next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. We are back. Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here with Jim Tipton, the founder of FindAGrave.com, just bought by Ancestry.com. And, you know, so many exciting things happening with Ancestry, Jim, ever since their purchase last year. And you are the latest beneficiary of that. First of all, obviously, we're not going to get into the details of the deal itself, but how does that come down in terms of you had to have some concerns about what would happen now with your baby after all these years?
Yeah, absolutely. One does not make that decision lightly. And what had happened basically was, as we said in the first segment, Find a Grave had grown so big, and I was essentially running it. You know, we've got this incredible community of millions of people, and then really these incredible set of administrators that have been working on the site. But when it came to, like, actually building out the site, it was still just me. It was just way too big to keep going in that manner. And I realized that really the site was falling behind because I basically couldn't keep up. And so to try to kind of find a solution, I realized it had to get bigger. And one way to do that was to work with Ancestry. They approached me. I've had a relationship with Ancestry for years. And, you know, initially it was kind of just a notion that I tossed around in my head. And then I realized, wow, that really would help me move the site forward. And in the ways that I've wanted to for years, but I just haven't been able to, with many more resources at my disposal or whatever. And, you know, I obviously wouldn't have done it if I didn't think it was the right move for Find a Grave. This wasn't about, like, a personal decision for me. This was about how can we move the site forward. Again, like I said, in ways that I've wanted to for years, I've had terrific ideas for years. Contributors have sent in terrific ideas for years, and I just haven't been able to implement them. And now I think Find a Grave users will, if they stick around, you know, just wait out. It's going to take a few months before they start seeing changes, but there's a whole bunch of good changes, great changes, really, that they'll start to notice because of this new arrangement. I think it's going to be a great move for the site long term. Again, like I said, it's we got a few months to get the ball rolling here, but... I'm excited about where we're moving.
Well, and it's going to remain a free site, first of all, which is very important to the community.
That's everyone's first question. Will it remain a free site?
Yes.
Absolutely. It will remain a free site from now moving forward. I understand there's a lot of concerns when there's any change. I'm a skeptical guy myself.
Sure.
But again, this, like you said, this is my baby. I would not have made this move if I didn't think my baby was going to be... treated in the right way.
Right. You're giving away your baby at the altar, but you're still in the family. I get this.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm here. I'm going to, you know, keep steering the site in the ways that I have for years. All of our existing policies are remaining in terms of, you know, users retaining copyright of their photos and all of that stuff. Nothing really is changing. If you're a Find a Grave user, you won't notice any big change right away. What you will notice is steady improvements to the site, to the support, to all of those things.
Well, I was looking at, you know, most of your graves, most of them are right here in the United States.
Yeah.
And I know you have access in your drop-down menus for pretty much any country, but not a lot of action there yet. Do you see that this is part of that movement to start filling in those other nations?
Yeah, absolutely. Find a Grave has always been an English-speaking site, and again, part of that is because I don't have the resources to translate it into all these different languages. But Ancestry does, and they've done this already with other, you know, with their own site. And absolutely, one of the early places we'd like to get on the roadmap is to get it in other countries, because there's a ton of volunteers in other countries who would love to start doing this too. We just got to get it in the right language for them. So that's definitely something we're planning on. Also, a mobile app is an absolute no-brainer.
Oh, yes.
that we should have had years ago. And I started working on one, and it just didn't ever materialize. So that's one of the early things we would really love to get out the door to.
What country would you say is number one on your hit list? Would it be Canada? Would it be England? Mexico?
England and Canada are they're taken care of already because they speak English.
Right. So, but there's still not as much action there as there is, say, here.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't. You're right. But more I would like to expand into the other. You know, I would love to get Spanish up there,
mm-hmm.
German, French.
So you're not thinking in terms of countries as much as you are languages.
Yeah, we're there in terms of support for the countries, right? We support. You can go add a grave in South Africa if you want, and there are some there. But you're right. It's a minority of our content. But yeah, we are looking forward to expanding beyond the U.S. and really making a push into the rest of the world.
Jim, this is exciting. Any other areas of improvement that you think we should know about that's going to be coming in the coming months?
I just think it's going to be more stable. There's going to be better support. Again, with the skeleton crew we've been running on, our support, frankly, hasn't always been the best over the years, and that may be understating it. So that's going to get better. And again, just really improvements to the site is what I think most people will notice and what I'm most excited about. Because again, I'm an ideas guy, and I've had all these ideas just, you know, sketched down on this big to-do list, and I've just had to watch them kind of rot away there or whatever, and now to be able to see some of these move forward is exciting for me, and I think it's going to be exciting for the users of the site.
Have you had any other ideas that might affect researchers for their family that you might get into in the future?
There's tons of ideas. I don't know that I'd go down a list because I don't know which ones will actually materialize.
Would really work,
and
yeah.
Which won't. So I don't want to promise anything, but there's tons of ideas that I have had, and like I said, other people have submitted that we would love to get up there. Things like notifications when, you know, on a person's, the anniversary of their death or their birthday, where you might get an email that says, how about making a virtual visit to their grave and coming and leaving some flowers for them. That's not really a research one, but yeah, there's tons of ideas.
The tie-in. Okay, and finally, I got to hear about the antique coffin screwdriver.
The antique coffin screwdriver.
Yes.
Well, when you run a site like Find a Grave, people give you weird things.
They do? They send these things to you?
What's that?
They send these things to you?
Well, this was a gift from a family member.
Okay.
From my mother or my sister, I think. But I have several little odd trinkets like that and a little shelf, kind of the Find a Grave shrine in my home.
Okay.
And that's kind of the crowning piece. It's this antique coffin screwdriver, and it's a ratcheting screwdriver. It's really old. It's like from 1850 or something.
Oh, wow. So it's an antique in itself. All right.
Yeah. And it only screws in, so which is all you would need in a coffin, but I just love that there's no like reverse to let you unscrew it. So it's just this ratcheting, this old heavy screwdriver that only screws in, which is just a funny little thing to own.
You know, I pictured something entirely different. I was picturing an antique coffin that was a screwdriver. But what it is.
Put out by Decatur Coffin Company out of Illinois, I think. And it was literally made to screw the lids onto
coffins. I get it now. Okay, yeah, what were some of the other things that people have sent you?
Oh, I've got an antique embalming fluid jar. I have a more modern coffin crank used to screw down the. These are just the weird things.
No, this is great.
Find a Grave was listed in Ripley's Believe It or Not. It was one of those, you know, it was like, Believe It or Not, this site exists, and someone sent me a little clipping of that. That's up on that shelf. Yeah, just like oddball stuff like that.
So I can understand then why one of your favorite books is Stealing Lincoln's Body by Thomas Crogwell.
Yeah, it was an interesting read. It was amazing what happened to Lincoln's body after. It's enough to fill a book.
Do you regret, Jim, that you didn't become an embalmer or somebody, a mortician?
No, absolutely not. I'm not one to work in that industry.
Jim Tipton.
I'm much happier to be the guy who started Find a Grave.
Jim Tipton, founder of findagrave.com. Congratulations on your new association with Ancestry.com. And we can't wait to see where it goes from here.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited. Everyone, now that we have a true Find a Grave team, we're all pretty excited about it.
Thanks, Jim. Look forward to having you back again in the future. And coming up next, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. Talking about preserving your tapes, believe it or not, there's a certain way you need to store them to make sure that they don't break down. Tom will have the whole thing for you coming up next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. It's Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He's our authority on preservation of all things family history, and you always give us such a great education, Tom. Glad to have you here. And by the way, if you ever have any questions for him, you can email him at asktom@tmcplace.com. He'd be happy to help you out. Tom, I've had people ask me about leaving films, pictures, recordings, all kinds of personal items at stores like yours, anywhere in the country. Is there a standard for keeping track of this? Because obviously, they're often, mostly, one-of-a-kind items. And there's always that possibility of loss within a store. You know, you'd hate to see something like that. How do stores in your industry keep track of this stuff and make sure that it doesn't disappear?
That's actually a great question. Unfortunately, the industry isn't standardized, and that's one thing you should ask whenever you are shipping stuff to a store or you're physically bringing them in. Ask them, how do you keep track of this? What do you do once I had you my memories? Like you said, most of them are one of a kind. We had a lady in just the other day that brought in some DVDs of her family, and she says, I have no copies of these. These are the only things I have. Can I wait for them? And, you know, once in a while, if a machine's open, we can do that, but usually that's impractical to do something like that. And so what we do, and most of the people in the industry do this, they use barcodes. So we, you know, put a barcode on every single item that she has, then we number them. So basically, if somebody's using the barcode system like we are, we could actually take our whole store, put everybody's stuff in a big drum, roll it around, mix it all up, and we could take out every roll of film, every cassette, everything, and know exactly who it goes to because everything has a barcode before it ever exits your tub.
And I know that when you've returned things to me, those barcodes are on my original pieces of media so that if I wanted to do it again, you can actually go back and look up the record of it and what you've done before, what machine you worked on, right?
Oh, exactly. In fact, we had somebody just last week brought in 10 video cassettes, and I'm going through and barcoding them as I'm talking to her, and three of them already had our barcodes on. I go, now these ones we've already done before. Did you need them done again? Did you lose your DVD? And she goes, I did. I don't remember bringing those in. I shot the barcode, instantly brought up what day she brought them in, what day she picked them up, all this kind of information about it. And then she goes, oh, you know what? Let me go check. And sometimes they've lost them. Sometimes they just forgot that they had done those ones.
And so is this typical? You say there's no industry standard, but is this typical of a lot of stores to keep track in this method?
Oh, absolutely. Any professional store out there is going to do this kind of stuff. If somebody's working out of their house, I'd be real scared. I've heard so many horror stories about things happening that little Sally spilled her orange juice on something that you had dropped off at a place like that.
Because they're working out of the basement.
Exactly.
Ooh.
But anybody in the industry, most of your big box retailers, places like that, they use the barcode system as well. Just, you know, check. Ask questions. You know, there. If you ask a question and they don't want to answer it, that should be a red flag. Because anybody that wants to help you should be able to do everything they can to answer your question to put you at ease. In fact, another good question is we had somebody call from back east the other day that wants to send some stuff in, and they're just really scared about, you know, UPS is tracked, FedEx is tracked, but they're still a little bit, you know, disconcerted that something
right.
might happen to
well,
them.
Well, and sure, then they're sending something through the mail, so it's not in their hands, it's not even in your hands
exactly.
to keep track of that. So what is the answer?
The answer to that, we have two options. We have these little GPS trackers. They can order a box from us that we send them the box, the packing materials, everything, and then they just put it all in, close it up, flip the on switch on the GPS navigator, drop it off at, you know, one of our drop-off locations across America, and then they are able to track it on their computer 24/7. They can see it's in the tarmac at Dothan, Alabama. It's driving down Highway 89, and they can actually physically track it 24/7.
So you're not talking about typical of the Postal Service that says, hey, it's in this facility now, and now it's in this facility, and now it's at the airport. You're saying that it will tell you every foot of the trip where it is by GPS.
Oh, yeah. It's actually a navigator, just like the navigator in your car, except that navigator is in this box, and you can go on, and through the satellites, it pinpoints exactly where it is. And it will tell you absolutely where it is. Like you mentioned, the post office and UPS, when they scan it, it sends a thing to their computer saying it is such and such a place. It has gone through the scanner. But when it goes from that scanner to the next scanner, nobody knows for sure where it is. They know it was supposed to have been loaded on this truck. This way, if it gets loaded on the wrong truck, you still know what truck it's on.
If the truck's stolen, you know that it's heading off to Canada or
That's right. If you know that truck's supposed to be on its way to Salt Lake City or Orlando, Florida, and you see it heading towards New York, you can call 911 and say there has been a UPS truck, you know, commandeered.
And my 19th century ancestor's photo is in it.
Exactly.
You must rescue it.
Give them the longitude, the latitude, and they can apprehend them.
So what happens when you get that back? You obviously have the device.
Uh-huh.
You're able to turn it off and use it again
in
the future?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. We turn it off, put it on a charger. Then we do the job because they know it's in our building now.
Right.
We do the job, and then when we send it back, we put the tracker back into the box. It goes back to them. They can track it coming back to them. Then once they get it, they just mail the back to us in a prepaid little box.
Is that an expensive service? Is that an additional thing? How does that work?
Generally, most of the people that do this service, it usually runs about $50. If somebody has a certain size order, they'll usually just throw it in at no charge.
So it can be an added value from the business.
Exactly, exactly. Generally, it's included in the service. If you know somebody wants it for something smaller, there might be a little charge. But the most I've ever seen anybody usually charge for something like this is like $50.
So, Tom, here's another thought that would concern me. Say I'm bringing down an old home movie, 1950s, 40s, 60s, whatever it is, and I'm going to be leaving it with you for a while. Maybe I'm dealing with somebody who's, like you say, is dealing out of their basement at home. Is there a concern about the climate, the temperatures that they're dealing with at the store? Or is that something I should be more worried about how I store it at home?
The answer to that is yes. You should be interested in both. The same thing, somebody working out of their house, you don't know what the climate control they have in their building is. You don't know if they've got it in a closet, they've got it in their basement that's too cold, too damp, too hot. You have no idea. They could be storing it out in their barn or their garage. You have no idea. When you bring it to legitimate business, a warehouse store or a small independent store like us, you know, we've got it climate controlled. We have the right temperatures. We have the right humidity, all that kind of stuff to keep it safe. And so once it leaves our place, we tell people this is how you need to store your stuff. If you're in a place that's high humidity, like the Deep South or something like that, get some uncooked rice, put it in a little cheesecloth, tie it up with a rubber band, put it in a Ziploc bag with your film or other things you have. And then that will absorb the water, you know, the humidity, if there's too much humidity. But usually you got to be careful with film and stuff like that. Water is the worst thing for film. We've had stuff that's gone through fire that we've been able to recover. So that's not the big thing. But you want to make sure it's somewhat climate controlled. Don't put it out in your barn, especially 16-millimeter film, because it has such a large surface. The heat will basically make it break down. So if you're opening a can of old film and it smells like vinegar, your film is breaking down. You need to get that transferred ASAP.
And so what about in attics?
Attics are really bad because they go from extreme hot to extreme cold. It's better to be a little bit on the warm side constantly or a little bit on the cold side constantly than hot and cold and hot and cold because it's expanding, contracting, expanding, contracting. So you need to be very, very careful with that. We had a customer that brought in, they had probably about 10 tins of film that was up in their closet. And they brought them in and hadn't opened them for probably 30, 40 years. And I could smell something.
Uh-oh.
I started opening them, and the ones that were on the bottom of the shelf almost just disintegrated because they didn't realize it, but there was a heating duct that went right along the bottom of that shelf.
Oh.
So the top part of the heating duct was that shelf. And so it basically just turned them into dust. And the higher up it got, the better preserved they were because they were kind of insulated from it. So be careful just putting it in your closet. Make sure you don't have a heating duct there. Don't put it by floor vents that are going to be blowing on it. If you put stuff under your bed, be careful there's no vents there that's going to make it hot or cold or things like this. And another thing that a lot of people don't understand is videotapes. You want to stand them on their ends. Do not stand them flat, because on most videotapes, the control track is on the end of the tape. If something happens to one of the springs inside of a tape and that spindle kind of drops down and crushes your control track, that can make it so we can't get anything off your tape.
Ooh.
But if you're storing it on its end, the wheels, even if the springs break, they're kind of suspended in air. So make sure you don't stack your tapes on top of each other. You make them standing on the ends, either the long end or the short end, so the tape's kind of free. And another thing that people have been educated incorrectly, in the old days when you rented a videotape, it says, please rewind. The reason it says that is so the next customer can pop it in and play it. The worst way to keep your tapes is rewound, because when they rewind fast and they rewind tight. Or when they play, they're kind of loose on the other end, and they're not so tight, which can cause print through, or what somebody would understand as an echo. So when they're watching a tape, they're hearing almost an echo before they hear the original audio. So always store them, like when I worked at the TV stations, we always stored everything what we call tells out. So we played it all the way forward and then stored it like that till we needed it. Then we rewound it and then played it. So the video stores are doing that as a convenience, not as a way to preserve tape.
Wow. That's why you're the authority. Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. Ask him questions at asktom@tmcplace.com, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. We'll see you then.
Well, there goes another Fast Hour. We want to once again thank Jim Tipton, founder of findagrave.com, for joining us on the show today. Great information. Amazing how he started it and what it has turned into. We also want to remind you that we got a great poll up on Find a Grave. Have you made some great discoveries using it? Cast your vote at extremegenes.com. And remember to use our find line, 1-234-56-GENES. You can leave your stories, ask questions. We'd be happy to hear from you. Talk to you again next week on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.